Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Well, welcome to another episode of the Thriving Farmer Podcast. My name is Michael Kilpatrick, and I'm the host. And today, my guest is Teresa Podol from Prairie Road Organic Seed in Fullerton, North Dakota. Since 1997, Teresa and her husband, Dan, have been passionate about providing resilient organic seed varieties with a focus on taste and abundance for their customers. Teresa, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Absolutely. Give us a little bit of kind of background of how you got started farming.
So I grew up on a farm, as did my husband, Dan, and we met in college. And I was taking an ecology of land use class from Professor Don Scobie at NDSU. And one of the classes, he threw up slides of his certified organic farm in Minnesota. Mm. Now, mind you, this was 1982.
Yes.
83 was the calendar year, the school year. And so I had never heard of organic farming before. And so I ran back from the class and found Dan, who I'd been dating for about 4 months by that time, and told him about this class, and he very quietly said, "Well, we farm organically."
Okay.
So it was quite a shock for me. He had never shared that with me because he knew I came from a conventional farm background and didn't know what I might think of that. That was very much at a time where you kept your head down. You didn't advertise the fact that you were organic. And so I tell people I married the guy.
Yeah.
And so when Dan and I came back to the farm, it was 1984. The farm had begun its transition to organic agriculture in the late 70s. So the it was certified. It was one of the first organic farms certified in North Dakota. And so we came back and joined the operation in 84, and our piece of the operation was going to be raising turkeys, which their dad had started a turkey layer flock, and that was what Dan and David grew up with. And so our endeavor was to produce certified organic turkey and sell that into the marketplace. Now, mind you, this was before USDA had a definition of what constituted organic meat. So we had to put negative claims on our labels saying grown without antibiotics, fed grains grown without pesticides, that sort of thing.
Correct.
And we couldn't claim that it was organic. But we lost our processor after about 10 years of building this enterprise. And so we had that link in the chain that was broken. So we had to pivot. We weren't about to leave the farm. So we took stock of what were our resources and our skill sets. And one of the main aspects of our farm was that we work to feed ourselves first. And so the garden was central to the farm. And everybody was hands-on. Everyone was involved. I grew up with my mom having sole authority or sole responsibility for the garden. And so this was a real change for me that, you know, it was such an important part to the entire family. And we had multi-generations on the farm at the time. Dan's mom and dad were still on the farm. And Dan was farming with his brother, David. And then it was Dan and I and our family. and we had children by that time. And so we started contracting with other garden seed companies and doing contract production for them. So that was our segue into the seed world. And for years, David had been working in the garden to breed varieties of various crops that he wasn't real happy with the varieties that were available to him as an organic gardener. And so he started dabbling around in breeding vegetable varieties. And so as luck would have it, one of our first companies that we worked with was out of Montana, Garden City Seeds. And we were introduced to John Navazio, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Absolutely, yes.
At that time. And so that relationship really spurred us on in terms of thinking about doing breeding and selection work for organic garden and farming systems. That was our start.
Okay. So you started doing large-scale contracting. Now, let's kind of pivot back to that organic part there. This was before certified. What year did you guys end up being actually officially first started to be certified organic?
So I believe they started the process in 77. Now, this is before my time, and I believe they were first certified in 1979.
Okay.
It was at that time there was no support systems really for certified organic farmers. There were a number of farmers that found themselves accidentally or found each other accidentally by all attending an organic fertilizer symposium that was held in Bismarck. And this was a gentleman that was looking to sell inputs to organic farmers. And I don't think any of the farmers purchased any of the fertilizer, but they found each other through this and they formed the North Dakota Natural Farmers Association, which then evolved into Northern Plains Sustainable Ag Society. So.
Okay. And then, so you were certified organic through then, and then you also are real certified as well through the Real Organic Project. Talk to us about like what that means to you.
Yes. Yeah, so we were on the ground floor of working with other NGOs, nonprofit organizations, and certification agencies to develop the original standards. And I was actually working as the executive director of Northern Plains Sustainable Ag Society when all that was going down. And so when USDA started certifying hydroponic operations, and of course, you know, the ongoing battle about what certified livestock production standards should be and access to pasture, you know, that was always an issue with the standards, holding the line on access to pasture and what those livestock standards should look like. And so I guess a lot of us who had been in on the ground floor and had worked so hard to develop those standards just have been really unhappy with the direction the USDA standards, the direction that was going, and really wanted to provide consumers and the farmers who were, you know, holding the line on what, you know, the higher level or the higher standards that organic should entail. And so we decided we needed to have an add-on label. And so it's about keeping the soil inorganic, about access to pasture and the integrity of the organic seal. So Bearing that seal is about raising awareness about what real organic should look like. Mm-hmm. So very passionate about holding the line on. And, you know, if you think about hydroponics and a system of livestock production that doesn't include access to pasture, you're then looking at a very input intensive system. And both of those are input reliant. And organic is about creating systems. And certainly part of that system is the soil. You cannot
absolutely
take the soil out of organic.
So let's go to what that means on your farm. So you mm-hmm. talked about, you know, the many of those organic systems being very input heavy. So how do you reduce inputs on your farm and kind of, because you're growing seeds and seeds is a much longer growth time than most crops. I mean, weeds obviously is another big part of your management as well.
Yeah, you know, when we first came back to the farm, the system that we designed was just so lovely in that we had the turkey operation and then we had a small grains operation, and there was just a flow of nutrients through that whole system, right? The grains were fed to the turkeys and then the turkey manure and the fertility from that fed the grain system. And so we still have a flock of chickens on the farm. We compost it's really a dry composting. It's not compost in the sense of the USDA organic standards. We basically pile it, and it's partially decayed manure, and then that gets put out onto our seed plots the year after that particular plot was in production. So we have about 40 acres. It's been 30, but we just added another 10 acres to our seed production plots. It's in a 3-year rotation. So what was in seed production this year won't see seed again for 2 more years. So there's 2 years off. Now this next year, what was in production in 2023 will receive that partially decayed chicken manure and hay and any of the refuse from our vegetable seed production system that all goes into that pile and that gets spread out over the land and immediately planted into cover crops. And so the 2-year cycle is it receives the chicken manure, cover crops, and cover crops again the following year and then back into seed production. And so that's our system of maintaining fertility. And, you know, we're not taking a lot of production off of the ground, but we are taking the seed, which, you know, the whole goal of the plant is to pour nutrition into that seed. So we're very cognizant of what we are taking out of the ground and making sure that we're replacing that and putting that back.
Okay, so what of your seed crops would you say is the most uses the most nutrients?
Well, yeah, there's certain crops that are heavier feeders than others, and we make sure that when we're rotating our crops, it's interesting when you plant your cover crops, you can see which ones were the heavy feeders.
Interesting.
And
okay,
we interseed our corn production, we use it as windbreaks. So we might have, let's say, our watermelon patch, and then right next to it is a couple of rows of corn on both sides of it. And so that serves as a windbreak and just diversifies the landscape a little bit more, right? So we're separating watermelon, corn, the next plot might be the squash, and then a couple more rows of corn, and that can be sweet corn or popcorn. And when you plant the cover crops the next year, where you see the evidence that there's less fertility is where that corn was planted. So okay. That's by far the what appears to be the heaviest feeder, just by the evidence from the cover crops. Haven't looked that closely at some of the other crops, but that is definitely noticeably evident where the yes. corn was grown.
And then for the corn varieties, is that something that you're selling as a seed corn?
Yes. Yep. Yes. One of the things that makes our seed company unique is that we grow all of the seed that we pack. So none of it is purchased from elsewhere. And okay. I only know of one other seed company that does that, and that's Wild Garden Seeds.
Yes.
Frank Morton and his wife, Karen. I believe they're the only other seed company, at least that I'm aware of, that. And there's been a lot of seed companies that have sprung up lately, and there may be some of those that are fairly newly minted that I'm not aware of. But so that's one of the things about our seed company. We're very passionate about that, in that we want to maintain control of our seed and to continuously do the selection work on it. And so we don't have a large offering. We're relatively small as seed companies go, but we're very hands-on about the varieties that we do offer, literally hands-on. You know exactly where that seed was grown, under what conditions it was grown, and whose hands harvested the seed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
I'm assuming then you use different methods to harvest the seed. So let's say the corn, you probably have a combine to harvest it, or what scale, I guess, is two on these different crops?
Actually, no. We hand harvest everything that we produce.
Okay.
And the purpose for that is, when we're harvesting corn, for instance, we want to handle every cob. And we're looking at those cobs and doing our selection work as we go through it. And what I mean by that is, we maintain a stock seed program for all of the varieties that we produce. So as we're harvesting the corn, we're looking at each one of the cobs and each one of the plants that we pull that cob off of, to see whether or not this particular cob has the qualities we're looking for to make it into our stock seed. And
okay.
And so if we mechanically harvested that, you could go through and, you know, select what you think might be the best looking ones, but you wouldn't be handling each and every cob like you do if you hand harvest everything. So we are working on a scale that Dan and I can harvest. We used to have our kids at home. They're no longer here. So it's Dan and I. And then his brother David helps during crunch times as well. But so it's the three of us at max, and most of the time, Dan and I. So that's the scale we're working on. We do not mechanize any of our harvesting. So it's all done by hand. And part of that is to enhance seed quality as well, because anytime you mechanically harvest, you are going to damage seed coats and and compromise the germination and the how long-lived that seed would be. So conventional wisdom will tell you that onion seed, for instance, does not last more than a year.
Yes.
Well, yes, if you mechanically harvest the onion seed and you're damaging seed coats. But if you hand harvest and you handle that onion seed very carefully, it actually, you can enhance how long-lived that seed would be. So we're looking for strong germination rates, the least amount of damage in handling as we can manage to not inflict, and And that translates into strong, vigorous seedlings. And in addition to that, the ongoing selection work, where we don't pamper any of our varieties. They have to make it on their own. So we don't irrigate any of our seed crops. It's all dry land farmed. Normally we get about 21 inches of rain here. So, you know, we're a pretty blessed region of the country. But as of late, those rain periods might come in deluges, and we might go through extended periods of drought. We've always had hot, dry periods, you know, traditionally here in North Dakota, where the crops have to make it. And usually it was during the small grain harvest, which was very advantageous to have that dry period in the fall. Mm-hmm. That does not hold true anymore. There's no patterns to rely on in terms of the weather cycles here. And so what we're doing is basically working to adapt plants to the changing environment. And I remember when I was working for Northern Plains Sustainable Ag Society, we had an organization called the Farm Breeding Club. And we were looking at doing much of what we're talking about, adapting seed to organic farming systems, but for field scale crops. And I remember meeting with the plant science, the plant breeders at our land-grant universities in this region and talking about this concept. And when we were first working with them, I remember plant breeders making the comment about, well, plants adapt very slowly. Mm. And we pushed back on that and said, well, that's not our observation. We believe that plants can adapt very quickly to the changes in their environment and changes in the production system. And it wasn't until years later that they discovered epigenetics, meaning where they discovered that plants have the ability to turn genes on and off in response to their environment. So they can pivot in one growing season, they can turn genes on and off and adapt to what's going on. And so it's really interesting what we're learning now about the interplay between genetics and yes, the ecology, what's going on around the plant and how it can respond to disease, pests, drought, heat, cool periods in the spring when it's trying to get going. And so what we're trying to do is provide that environment where we're allowing the plant to do its thing and adapt to what's going on in the environment and the changes and the challenges, and then saving the seed from the very best performers regardless of what's going on. And so one of the axioms we talk about, I'm sure you can imagine that not watering when you're going through an extended period of drought is very nerve-wracking. And if we were still contract producers, it would be even more so, because as a contract producer, you're selling based on volume, right? Well, yes, as a seed producer that's packing its own seed, the silver lining of a year that's not a good production year is that means it was a good selection year. So it had a lot of selection pressure. And so what that means for our customers is that by supporting this work, they are supporting that plant's journey to adapt to a changing environment and adapt to be more resilient to whatever diseases, pests, and adverse growing conditions come their way. So,
yeah. So then you're no longer, you don't contract grow. You just grow for your website.
We still do a little bit of contract production, okay. But as Deanna and I get older, we think very carefully about that.
Yeah.
There are some crops that we recently gave up. One of them is cucumber seed, because in order to produce 100 pounds, 200 pounds of cucumbers, you've got to go through, you got to handle a lot of cucumbers. And as we age, our hands, we were really feeling it. And like, okay, we're asking for carpal tunnel surgery.
Yes. Here.
And so to be kinder to our bodies, there are some crops that we've given up and, you know, helped our, the seed companies that we were working with, training new producers, sharing our tips and strategies for how to do this production. So trying to be helpful to the next generation coming up as they engage with this work. So,
yeah. New to gardening or homesteading and dreaming of growing your own fruits? We make it easy with fresh elderberry cuttings available for pre-order now. With proven, easy-to-grow varieties like Adams or Ranch to more exotic varieties such as Pocahontas or Wildwood, you can easily start your own elderberry patch. No matter your skill level, these elderberries will thrive on your land. Head over to growelderberry.com to sign up for our free workshop on how to thrive with elderberries or shop cuttings. Go to growelderberry.com. So what would you say is the hardest part of seed production?
Oh, you know, there's two facets to that. Certainly the physical demands is one. But then also just the mapping of everything and the tracking and continually monitoring what's going on and knowing what to pay attention to and having the time to give it that attention. So, you know, we try to organize our workflow during the year to make sure that we can cover our bases, right? And some parts of the season are more challenging than others. So, you know, and I think the thing that we didn't necessarily bank on or were prepared for as we embarked on this work is growing and harvesting, then cleaning and packing and selling your seed is a year-round cycle. So by the time you're, you know, by the time you're finishing up harvesting, you're already working on marketing, getting the catalog prepared, updating your website. So even before you finish harvesting, you're already working on that. And, you know, traditionally the winter season is a time to catch your breath and take stock and plan for the next year and get your taxes done and all of that. Well, that period is now also consumed with getting seed out the door. So, you know, packing up orders and packing seed in seed packets and, you know, doing all the planning work that farmers need to do during those winter months to gear up for another season. So there's no downtime for us now. It's go time all season long. So that's one of the real challenges about the work that we're currently doing is that you're constantly on.
Yeah. So then with the seeds, obviously what you're saying is you get a year round thing. So, and obviously you could start certain things at different times of the year, like beans, you could plant those super early and a little bit later, but being so far north, you probably actually have a pretty specific window that those get planted in, correct?
Right. Yeah. With our short growing season, you know, our last frost is about the third week of May, traditionally around the 20th to the 27th. And our first frost is usually around September 15th through the 20th, somewhere in there. Now, I say usually with tongue in cheek because we've had frosts in June as of late. And we've had extended fall seasons where we've not had frost till into well into October. So a full 4 weeks later than our historic average. So, yeah, things have changed a lot. And this winter is a case in point. You know, we've got frost coming out of the ground as we speak and water going down. It's just incredible. That has never happened in my experience ever. So that's amazing to me.
Yeah. And with spinach, that's a biennial. So do you plant that in the fall and then let it overwinter?
So yeah, we handle a bunch of biennial crops. And so like our onions, for instance, we store the bulbs over the winter. Same with parsnips. You harvest the roots and store them. Carrots are another one. Beets. So the root crops, a lot of those are biennial. And so you have to harvest what we call stecklings. So we don't store a full-size carrot or a full-size parsnip. We usually plant them sometime in July and then harvest in the fall. And so they're smaller, but you have to plant back the roots in the spring. And so they're one of the first things that we plant in the spring is those root crops that are biennial and we're going to take to seed the following year. So, yep.
All right. And then do you do any production in tunnels or is there anything done outside?
Nope. We don't do anything in tunnels, high tunnels. We do start tomato seeds and we'll start onions. We both start onions and we've done some direct seeding of actual onion seed and I've had some good luck with that, but it's we hedge our bets by doing it both ways. And so onion seedlings are one of the first things we seed in the greenhouse. And then tomatoes is the other main crop that is, we do start lettuces as well. So our lettuce crops, a lot of our flower crops. And we started out with very few flowers and herbs, but we have always interseeded flowers in our gardens. And it's about encouraging that biodiversity at the garden level and providing habitat for beneficials. And so we started incorporating more flowers and herbs into our offerings. For that very reason, these are the ones that we plant in our gardens to develop that ecology of place and to encourage that biodiversity. And, you know, when I have gardeners talk to me about the various pests that are plaguing their gardens, you know, that's one of the strategies that they can use is to provide that habitat for the beneficial insects to help them with pest control. And if you get that right, you can greatly reduce the damage to where it might be annoying, but it's not going to wipe out your crop. So that has been a strategy of ours too, is to diversify our offerings to the level where we're encouraging gardeners to diversify their gardens as well. So, and trying to engage more in that give and take where we're not just selling them the seed, but we're also providing that information and support to help them deal with the issues that they're experiencing in their gardens.
Gotcha. So if someone's interested in getting into the seed game or, you know, starting to do their own seed production, what kind of advice would you give to someone, you know, who's just starting out?
So the main piece of advice I'd give them is to start saving seed for their own garden needs first. That you learn to take the crops that you're growing through their entire production system, and then doing that selection work for the ecology of place. So you're doing the selection work in your location for your disease and your pests and for your farming, your gardening system. Mm-hmm. And learn to do that and reap the benefits of that for your garden first, and then start scaling to where you can offer it to other gardeners. Starting with the self-pollinating crops is a really good strategy. When you get into the cross-pollinated crops, you have to have larger populations to avoid any inbreeding or bottlenecking the genetics. So when you start getting into the cross-pollinated crops, you have to take it to a much larger scale than your self-pollinating crops. So cutting your teeth on beans and peas and lettuces, you know, those crops that are smaller and that you don't need to have such a large population, that would be my advice to start there. And also, as more people get into seed production, to differentiate yourself in some way. When we started with our seed company, our initial offering was the varieties that we had bred on our farm. And then we expanded to varieties that we had done selection work on for our contract seed production. We were never happy with having the companies that we were growing for provide us with the seed. We insisted on, if we were going to grow that crop and that variety for them for, you know, future years, we wanted to do selection and start a stock seed program for that variety. Oftentimes when we would get seed in from a seed company, it was bin run. It was, and it might have been crossed up in one way or the other. So there were off types in there, which was very frustrating for as a contract producer, because if you're growing a cross-pollinated crop, for instance, and there's off types in there, that means the seed isn't going to be true to type. And if you wanted to try to rogue out the off types, you know, oftentimes you don't realize that there's off types in there until it enters its fruiting stage, where now it's already cross-pollinated and the fruit that sets on is your first clue that something's wrong here, something's amiss. This doesn't look like the zucchini variety you want us to be growing.
Yes, correct. So, absolutely, yeah.
So yeah, if you're looking to contract with seed companies to grow as a contract producer, you have to ask questions about the stock seed, the seed that they're sending you for you to grow. Do they have a stock seed program, and are they certain this is true to type? And as new producers, there are a number of varieties out there that are very difficult to produce in a contract situation, in that, like, maybe it's a tomato, they want a pound of seed. well, how seedy are these tomatoes? And or or there's tomatoes out there that are what they call pathinocarpic, where they don't set a lot of seed. They don't have a lot of seed. And maybe the first few sets, one of them is Oregon Spring. The first few sets of that fruit has literally no seed in it. So that means you're going to have to harvest a lot more tomatoes to get a pound of Oregon Spring tomatoes. So that would be my caution, is to know and understand the variety that they're asking you to produce, and to maybe even take a year to get to know that variety before you sign a contract to produce that seed. Because there are surprises out there, and or you know, just ask them point blank, what, you know, tell me about this variety and what are the challenges involved with this. And you know, if it takes a lot more fruit to get a pound of Oregon Spring tomatoes, then maybe that tomato should be compensated at a higher rate than, say, something that, you know, produces a lot of seed, like Brandywine tomatoes.
Yeah. So how many plants does it typically take to, I know you obviously just said there's a massive range, but how many plants does it typically take to get a pound of tomato seed?
Oh, yeah. Usually if we're planting tomatoes, it's like anywhere between 30 to 50 plants. So it doesn't take a ton of plants.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, you're harvesting throughout the season. But again, you got to know your tomatoes. If the first few sets of tomatoes don't have any seed in them, then, yeah, you probably want to up that population so that if you finally get good seed set right before frost, you want to be able to harvest, you know, from a lot of plants in order to get that pound of seed that you're looking for. So it's very dependent on, it's very variety dependent, and knowing the ones that have those tendencies to not have any seed in the first few sets is really important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So then what would you say your biggest like mistake has been, or like thing that went wrong? I'm assuming like maybe something was too close, or.
The biggest challenges for us has been getting seed from the seed companies as contract producers that are crossed up. Mm. And then what happens, you know, if they want you to clean it up, now you're in a selection contract and no longer in a production contract, because every plant that you take out is going to reduce your yield, so to speak, right?
Correct.
So, you know, I guess if when I look back, the reason why we made the switch from contract producers to producing our own seed is we had a small number of very large customers as a contract producer. And there was one year where we signed a contract, we were negotiating a contract with a seed company. We had actually signed the contract with them, and they were supposed to send us the seed to plant, right? The stock seed, so to speak. I hesitate to even call it that because most companies were not sending us from a stock seed program.
Yeah.
It was just production run. But they didn't send us the seed. We didn't get the seed. And it's time to plant. We still don't have the seed. And that was our tip off that, hey, we weren't going to be growing for them this year. And so that left a huge hole in our production that year.
Yeah.
It was a heavy hit. And it's kind of, you know, coming, I worked for a nonprofit for about 10 years. And nonprofit organizations, you're better off having a large number of small donors than a small number of large donors.
Correct.
Large donors are great, but you can't depend on them. They might decide that, oh, their focus is no longer organic agriculture, now they're interested in climate change or something like that. And so their funding priorities change. And so it's very similar to a farm situation in terms of risk management. Having that small number of large contracts, it just was not serving us in terms of managing risk in the marketplace. So now with, you know, gardeners across the United States, and their main, most of our customers are in our region. We market ourselves as a regionally adapted seed company, that our seed is adapted to northern growing climates. And we tout that, and we, you know, we get feedback from our customers that their gardens have never looked as good as when they started to use our seed. So, you know, all the seed is grown on our farm. We're continuously adapting it to our ecology of place, and we're increasing the varieties that we carry, the resilience of those varieties. So that's our focus, and our customers know it. So,
one last question here. How do you market your seeds?
So we have an online store. We did do seed racks quite aggressively. We had a seed rack program up until COVID hit.
Okay.
And, you know, then nobody was shopping in stores. And so our seed racks literally just sat there.
Correct.
And so we ended up asking our, the accounts that we were working with to just send us back the seed. And, they were literally sending their customers to our website to get their seed. So, you know, they literally told their customers where to go to get their seed. And we never went back to the seed rack program after COVID. And largely because by that time it was just Dan and I.
Yeah.
And the rush to get seed racks out right during the holiday season was not something that we were wanting to sign up for once we got out of it. So yeah, we never went back to that. So we market 100% online, and you know, we have a raving fan base out there of current customers that are continuously bringing us new customers. And so that's been really good. We have done a lot more work with helping people learn how to garden, and helping them navigate some of the challenges of gardening by providing them with tips and resources. That has been one of our main marketing focuses, is helping gardeners be more successful. I mean, that's the goal with the seed itself, mm-hmm. You know, with it being continuously selected and adapted to the ecology of place, and increasing resilience. The goal of that is to help our gardeners be more successful. And so with our marketing efforts, we're also focusing on that the more we can help our gardeners, the more we can help our customers, the more they're going to come back to us and see us as not just a seed company, but a resource for them. So that's the goal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And let our folks know where they can find you. It's prairieroadorganic.co.
Yep, .co, not .com, .co.
Okay, so prairieroadorganic.co. And are you on social media as well?
Yes, we have Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube are our main social media channels.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah. So folks can find you there. Well, Teresa, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you sharing about your passion for organic seed and just the great work you're doing to really create a regional seed supply that is focused on varieties that are suited for your specific area. So that's always awesome to see, because obviously that's going to be the more resilient seed than, you know, commercially massively produced for a very specific, you know, over in Israel. Again, I know we need to do some production like that, but as you said, I think it was really telling of you to say at the beginning there about the onion seed, because that's something we've experienced is after 1 year, it's done. And so
right.
As long as you can have the high quality hand harvested, you're going to have a lot better success.
Correct. Yep. And yeah, we are just very thankful to be able to do this work, and it's our customers that enable us to continue to do this selection work and to adapt varieties to our changing conditions, which we just feel very strongly that's only going to ramp up and increase, and the need to help our plants make the curve with us facing these the climate change issues that we're facing is going to be imperative.
Absolutely. So there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.